You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, 14 Lectures. Translation revised by Pauline Verla. Lecture 1 is entitled The Life of the Human Soul, given on the 23rd of November, 1923. Readers aside, that this is a set of lectures Steiner gave, a cycle, just before the start of the Christmas conference. And so it sort of completes a certain three sets of lectures that he gave. The second one was World History in the Light of Anthroposophy. The third one, Rosicrucianism and Modern Initiation, which sort of bookend each other into that. Again, Lecture 1, The Life of the Human Soul. My dear friends, let us make use of the time available for lectures at the Goetheanum, between now and Christmas, to help those who have come for the Christmas conference to absorb as much as possible of what the anthroposophical movement can bring to human hearts. What we can do at the last moment will then really stir the thoughts of those who are staying over Christmas. Not that I shall be speaking about the International Anthroposophical Society, that can be briefly covered at the conference. But I shall try to formulate what I say in a way that will help prepare the right mood for the forthcoming event. I shall, therefore, speak from a different point of view of a subject I have been dealing with in recent weeks, and will proceed from a description of the life of the human soul itself to speak of its entry into cosmic secrets. Let us begin in the simplest possible way, and consider what happens in the human soul if we practice self-reflection beyond the point I actually had in mind when I was writing the articles in the title Goetheanum Weekly. These four articles can serve as an introduction to what we shall now look at together. If we begin practicing self-reflection thoroughly and comprehensively, we shall realize how the life of the soul can be enhanced and intensified. What happens in the first place is that we let the external world work upon us. We have been doing this since childhood. And then we have thoughts that are the product of our inner world. Indeed, what makes us human beings in the real sense is that we allow the effects produced in us by the external world to live on further in our thoughts and are able to experience ourselves inwardly in these thoughts. We create a world of mental pictures that, in a certain way, reflects the impressions made upon us from outside. It is possibly not very helpful to our inner life to ponder a great deal on how the external world is reflected in our soul. By doing so, we do not get beyond a shadowy picture of the world of mental images in ourselves. A better form of self-reflection is to concentrate on the activity itself and try to experience ourselves in the actual element of thought, without regard to the external world, pursuing in thought what came to us as impressions of the external world. It will depend on a person's particular nature, whether he or she tends more toward thinking abstract thoughts. One person may or may not devise philosophical world systems or sketch abstract plans for anything and everything. Another person who has reflected about things that have made an impression on him, and then enlarges upon them in thought, may go more in the direction of imaginative ideas. We will not go further into how this inner thinking, without any external impressions, takes its course according to a person's temperament, character, or further disposition. We will, rather, make ourselves conscious of the fact that it is a special case when, as far as our senses are concerned, we withdraw from the external world and live for a change in our thoughts and mental images, enlarging upon them, often perhaps merely as possibilities. Some people, of course, consider it unnecessary to pursue further possible thoughts about existence and so on, even in difficult times like the present. You will often find people who are occupied with their business the whole day, providing all kinds of things required in the world. Afterward, getting together in small groups to play cards and such like, in order, as people so often say, to pass the time. And it will not often happen that people get together in similar groups in order to exchange thoughts, for example, about what might have happened in connection with the day's business if things had gone slightly differently. That would not be as amusing as playing cards. But it would have been doing some further thinking. And if they also retained a sound feeling for reality, there is no reason why such thinking need become mere fantasy. This living in thoughts leads finally to what you will experience if you read titled The Philosophy of Freedom properly. If you read that book, as it is meant to be read, you will understand what it means to live in thoughts. The philosophy of freedom is based upon experience of reality, but at the same time it is entirely the product of real thinking. Thus you will see that the philosophy of freedom has its own special mood. I conceived it in the 1880s and wrote it down in the early 1890s. But I have to say that among the kind of people whose job it ought to have been to at least take note of what the root nerve of the book is, I found a total lack of understanding. There is a particular reason for this. Even those who are called thinkers today are unable to experience their thinking otherwise than as a picture of the outer physical world. And then they say, perhaps something belonging to a superphysical world might arise in a person's thinking. But just as a chair or a table are outside us, yet our thinking assumes them to be inside, our thinking would have to be capable of experiencing a supersensible object outside us, just as the chair and the table are outside. This was approximately Edward von Hartmann's conception of the function of thinking. Then he comes across the philosophy of freedom. In that book, the argument is that to experience thinking in the real sense means that a person can come to no other realization than this. If you live in thinking in the real sense, you are living in the cosmos, even if, to begin with, in a somewhat undefined way. This connection of the deepest experience of thinking with the secrets of the world process is the core of the philosophy of freedom. This is why the statement is made in the book that in thinking we grasp one corner of the whole world mystery. This may be putting it simply, but what is meant is that when one experiences thinking in the real sense, one no longer feels outside the mystery of universal existence, but within it. One no longer feels outside the divine element, but within it. If one grasps the reality of thinking within oneself, one grasps the divine element within oneself. This was the point people could not comprehend. For if we really grasp it, if we make the effort to achieve this kind of thinking, we are no longer in the world in which we were, but in the etheric world. It is a world of which we know that it is not conditioned by any part of the physical earth, but by the whole cosmic sphere. We are within the etheric cosmos, and we can no longer have any doubts about the law and order of this cosmic sphere, if we have grasped thinking as it is understood in the philosophy of freedom. We have achieved what may be called etheric experience, and we realize we have taken a specific step forward in life. Let me characterize this step as follows. Our thinking and ordinary consciousness is concerned with tables, chairs, human beings, of course, and so forth. We may think of other things, too, but they all belong to the outside world. And as we grasp these outside things with our thinking, we do so from the center of our being. Everyone is aware that with his thinking, he wants to comprehend the things of the world. But once you achieve the experience of thinking I described just now, you are not grasping the world, nor are you merely confined within your ego center. Something quite different happens. You get the feeling, and quite rightly, that with your thinking, which is not localized in any particular place. You grasp everything inwardly. You feel you are making contact with your inner being. Just as in ordinary thinking you stretch your spiritual feelers outward, so with this thinking, which experiences itself in itself, you are continually stretching inward into your own being. You become object, object to yourself. It is a very significant experience to realize that whereas up till now it was always the world which you grasped, now with this experience of thinking, it is your own self you have to grasp. In the course of this firm grasp of your own self, you come to realize that you have broken out of your skin. You grasp yourself inwardly, and in the same way you grasp the whole world ether from within. Not, of course, in all its details, but you know with certainty that this ether spreads over the whole cosmic sphere in which you are, and in which are also the stars, sun and moon, and so forth. Now, a second thing a human being can develop in his inner soul life is that instead of being wholly occupied with thoughts that are prompted from outside, he gives himself up to his memories. If he does this and makes the process an inner reality, he will again have a quite definite experience. The experience of thinking I have just described to you does actually lead a person, initially, to his own self. He grasps his own self, and this process gives him a certain satisfaction. But when he passes on to the experiencing of memories, he will finally find, if he is inwardly active in the real sense, that the most striking feeling is not that of approaching his own self. That is what happens in the experience of thinking. And for that reason, a human being will find freedom in the course of this thinking, a freedom which depends entirely upon the personal element in him. That is why a philosophy of freedom must set out from the experience of thinking, for it is through this experience of thinking that a human being discovers his own self, finds his bearings as an independent personality. This does not happen in the case of the memory experience. If you proceed with real earnestness and are able to immerse yourself entirely in the experience, you will finally have the feeling of being liberated from yourself, of getting away from yourself. That is why the most satisfying memories of all are those which enable you to forget the present. I will not say they are always the best, but in many cases the most satisfying. You can certainly get an idea of the value of memory if your memories can carry you out into the world, no matter how utterly dissatisfied you may be with the present and wish you could get away from it. If you can waken memories which, as you give yourself up to them, give you an enhanced feeling of life, this will be a preparation for what memory will be like when it becomes much more real. You see, memory can become more real if you bring to life with the greatest possible exactness something you actually experienced years or even decades ago. I want to describe just what it is like. Suppose, for instance, you turn to a collection of old papers and take out letters you wrote on some particular occasion. You put these letters down in front of you and let them carry you back to the past. Or it is even better not to take letters you wrote yourself, or which others wrote to you, because the subjective element would be too strong. Try to get hold of your old schoolbooks and look at them as though you were still a schoolboy, actually bringing the past to life. The effect is remarkable. If you do as I suggest, you will entirely transform your present state of mind. You must exercise a little ingenuity here. You can do this with anything. For instance, a lady might come across a dress or something she has not worn for 20 years, and she puts it on and is transported back into the situation she was in at the time. Choose something which will bring the past into the present with the greatest possible reality. This enables you to separate yourself radically from your present experience. With our ordinary consciousness, we are too close to ourselves in our actual experience to get anything out of it. We must be able to get farther away from ourselves. Now, a person is farther away from himself when he is asleep than when he is awake. For during sleep, his astral body and his ego are outside his physical and etheric bodies. You get close to this astral body, which, as I have said, is outside the physical body during sleep, if you summon up some past experience into the present as vividly as possible. To begin with, you will probably not believe this, because you will be reluctant to attribute such significance to something so trivial as the awakening of past experiences by means of an old dress. But just put it to the test, and if you succeed in conjuring up some past experience into the present so vividly that you are wholly engrossed in it and can completely forget the present, you will find that you come close to your astral body, your sleeping astral body. But you will be mistaken if you expect that all you have to do is to look to your right or left and you will see a shadowy form that is your astral body. That is not how things work. You must pay attention to what actually happens, which may be, for instance, that after such an experience, you gradually begin to see the dawn and the sunrise very differently from hitherto. On this path, you will gradually begin to feel the warmth of the dawn as something that brings a message, as something which has an elemental prophetic power. You will begin to sense that the dawn has spiritual strength, and you will be able to see an inner meaning in this prophetic force. Although you may possibly have believed it to be an illusion at first, you will eventually feel there is some relationship between the dawn and your own being. Through the experience I have described, you will gradually come to sense as you look at the dawn, quote, "This dawn will not leave me alone. It is not that the dawn is merely over there and I am over here. There is an inner connection between my own being and the dawn. The dawn is part of my own soul. At this moment, I myself am the dawn." Close quote. If you have been able to unite yourself with the dawn in such a way that you experience the colored radiance out of which the sun rises in your very heart as a lively feeling, then you will also feel that you are actually traveling across the heavens with the sun, that, as I put it just now, the sun will not leave you alone, that it is not a case of your being here and the sun there, but that, in a sense, your existence reaches right up to that of the sun. In fact, that you journey through the day in company with the light. If you develop a sense for this, not out of thinking, where you approach your own being, but arrive at these experiences out of memory, in the way I have described, or to be more exact, out of the power of memory, then the things that you otherwise perceive with your physical senses begin to show a different face. They begin to become spiritually transparent. When you have acquired the feeling of traveling with the sun, when you have gained the strength from the dawn to travel with the sun, then all the flowers of the field will look different to you. The blossoms will not merely display the red or yellow colors on their surface. They begin to speak in a spiritual way to your soul. The blossoms become transparent. A spiritual element in the plant begins to stir, and the blossoming becomes a kind of speaking. In this way, you are actually uniting your soul with external nature. You get the impression that behind natural existence, the light with which you have united yourself is borne by spiritual beings. And in those spiritual beings, you gradually recognize the characteristics described by Anthroposophy. Let us now compare the two stages of feeling which I have just been describing. The first feeling, which can be had by an inner experience of thinking, is one of expansion. The feeling of being in the confines of space ceases altogether. Your experience widens, and you have a definite feeling that the core of your inner being extends into the cosmos and is of the same substance as the rest of the world. You feel one with the whole world, with the etheric element of the world. But as you stand here on the earth, you feel that your feet and legs are drawn down by the earth's gravity. You feel that your whole being is bound firmly to the earth. The moment you have this experience of thinking, you no longer feel bound to the earth. You feel dependent on the wide expanses of the cosmic sphere. Everything comes in from the expanses, not from below, as it were, from the center of the earth upward, but from the cosmic expanses. And you feel that to understand a human being, this feeling that there is a streaming in from the cosmic expanses must be present. This applies even to a true understanding of the human form. If I want to give expression to the human form in sculpture or in painting, I must picture to myself that only the lower part of the head proceeds from the inner bodily and spatial nature of the human being. I shall not bring the right spirit to the work unless I am able to convey the impression that the upper part of the head has been brought there from outside. The lower part of the head is formed from inside outward, but the upper part from outside inward. Our forehead, the top of our head, is actually always added from outside. If you looked with artistic understanding at the paintings in the small cupola of the Gertianum which was destroyed, you will have seen that this principle was always observed. The lower part of the face was always represented as having grown from within the human being, and the upper part of the head as something given him from the cosmos. This played an important role in times when these things were known. You will never understand the form of the head of a genuine Greek sculpture unless you associate this feeling with it, for it was out of similar feelings that the Greeks created their works of art. Therefore, in experiencing thinking, one feels oneself united with the surrounding expanses. Now, it might be imagined that this process would simply continue in this manner and go further and further outward as you pass from the experience of thinking to that of memory, but it is not so. If you succeed in developing within yourself the experience of thinking, you will finally have the impression of the third hierarchy, anguloi, arch, anguloi, archai. Just as you can picture a human being's bodily experience here on earth, in the working of gravity and in the process of the digestion of foodstuffs, you can picture the conditions under which the beings of the third hierarchy live if through this thinking experience, instead of trudging around the earth, you feel yourself borne by forces reaching you from the ultimate boundaries of the cosmos. Thinking experience, third hierarchy. Now, if you pass from the experience of thinking to that of memory, it is not a matter of being able to reach this ultimate boundary of the cosmic expanses. You can, it is true, reach this boundary if you know the reality of the thinking experience. But you do not go farther out still, for something different presents itself. An object may be in front of you, a crystal, a flower, or an animal. What happens when you pass from the experience of thinking to what the experience of memory can offer you is that you can see right into the object. When your gaze, which had extended to the ultimate boundary of the cosmic expanse, continues farther as an experience of memory, it penetrates into the essence of things. You do not press on into indefinite, abstract expanses, but this extended gaze perceives the spiritual element in all things. For instance, in light it sees the active spiritual beings of light, and so on, and in darkness the spiritual beings who are active there. So we can say the experience of memory leads us to the second hierarchy. Memory experience, second hierarchy. There is, of course, something in the life of the human soul that reaches beyond memory. Let us see what it is. Memory gives our soul its special coloring. Suppose we come across a person who criticizes everything, who reacts with bitterness to everything we say to him, who, whenever we tell him about something that is really pleasing, at once speaks of something unpleasant. In such a case, we may know with certainty that this characteristic is connected with his memory. Memory gives the soul its coloring. But there is something further than this soul coloring. We may encounter a person who meets us with an ironic sneer, particularly when we say something to him, or he wrinkles his forehead, or puts on a tragic expression. Or, on the other hand, he may give us a friendly look, so that we are cheered not only by what he says, but also by this look. When something important is said during a lecture, it is interesting sometimes to have a quick look at the faces in the audience, to see whether the expressions are cheerful or miserable, whether foreheads are wrinkled or not, and see the blankness in some faces and the mobility in others. What is being expressed there is not merely memory that has persisted in the soul and gives it its coloring, but something that has gone over from memory into a person's physiognomy, his gestures, his whole bearing. If a person takes in nothing, if his face betrays the fact that all the sufferings, sorrow and joy in his life have left him unimpressed, that too is characteristic. A face that has remained smooth and unlined is as characteristic as one that is deeply furrowed by the tragedy or the seriousness of life, or one that expresses much contentment. In such cases, what otherwise remains part of the life of soul and spirit, as the outcome of the power of memory, passes over into actual physical form. The effect is so strong that later on in life it is expressed outwardly in a person's gestures and physiognomy, while his temperament is inside. For in old age we do not always have the same temperament as we had in childhood. Our temperament in old age is often the result of what we have undergone in life and has become memory in the inner life of our soul. What enters into a person inwardly in this way can also become reality, though this is more difficult. It is comparatively easy to bring before the eyes of our soul something we experienced in childhood or many years ago, and to make the memory of it a fact. It is more difficult to transpose ourselves into the temperament we had in childhood or in our earlier years. But the practice of such an exercise can bring results of immense significance. We actually achieve more if we can do this with inner perseverance than if it is merely an external act. Something can certainly be achieved in a person if, say, at the age of 40 or 50, naturally within the obvious limits in such circumstances, he plays the games he played in childhood, if he skips as he did then, or if he even tries to make the same kind of face he made then, as an 8-year-old, his aunt gave him a sweet. If he can transpose himself back into the actual gesture or posture of that moment, he will again find that something is brought into his life whereby he is led to the conviction that the outer world is the inner world, and the inner world is the outer one. We can then penetrate with our whole being into, say, a flower, and then, in addition to the thinking experience and the memory experience, we have what I will call a gesture experience, in the best sense of the word. In this way, we acquire an idea of how the spiritual element is directly at work within the physical. You cannot, with your full consciousness, inwardly apprehend the gesture you made, perhaps 20 years ago, in response to some outer provocation, without realizing with the greatest inner depth and reverence the union of the physical and the spiritual in all things. But then you will have arrived at the experience of the first hierarchy. Gesture experience, first hierarchy. The memory experience enables us, when we see the dawn, to identify ourselves with it, and to feel and experience in ourselves its glowing warmth. However, when we break through to the gesture experience, what we meet with in the dawn will unite with everything that helps us experience the objective qualities of color, sound, and so on. When we simply look at the objects around us that are illumined by the sun, we see them in the way the light presents them to us. But the dawn changes when we pass gradually from the memory experience to the gesture experience. The color experience detaches itself entirely from the material part of it. It becomes living being, becomes soul, becomes spirit, abandons the space in which the outer physical dawn appears to us, and the dawn begins to speak to us of the mystery of the connection of the sun with the earth. We experience how the beings of the first hierarchy work. If we still direct our gaze to the dawn, and it still appears almost as it did through experiencing memory, we learn to recognize the thrones. And then the dawn dissolves away. The element of color changes into beings, becomes living, becomes soul, becomes spirit, and speaks to us of the relation of the sun to the earth as it was in the ancient sun period. Speaks to us in such a way that we experience the cherubim. And finally, if, with the enthusiasm and reverence aroused in us by this twofold revelation of the dawn, by the revelation of the thrones and the cherubim, we remain alive in our soul, there penetrates into us from the dawn, transformed now into living being, experience of the nature of the seraphim. Thinking experience, third hierarchy. Memory experience, second hierarchy. Gesture experience, first hierarchy. In all that I have been describing to you today, my aim has been to indicate how by simply following the course of the soul from thinking to thought-filled, soul-imbued gesture, the human being can develop feelings, to begin with no more than feelings, of the spiritual foundations of the world right up to the sphere of the seraphim. I wanted to present this to you as a kind of introduction to the lectures which will follow, and which, proceeding from the life of the soul, shall take us into the far expanses of the spiritual cosmos. The end of Lecture 1.